Well, I thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here. So I'm from PI. I have a bit the opposite problem of Philip, so I will speak about older things, some older works. And the main question here is basically, well, how can we actually observe things in quantum gravity, or how to measure quantum space-time? And that has been basically the main problem in quantum gravity. And let me first give you a taste of what observables mean in quantum, or how we understand observables in gravity, and in particular observables in quantum gravity. And to start with, of course, eventually we expect that gravity is a field theory. So let's maybe first look what we use as kind of observables in quantum field theory. And mostly we do actually quantum field theory in a perturbative formalism. In this case, of course, we have always, if you don't include gravity, we have a fixed space-time background. And in this case, something like the field at the point Tx is something which we can say is an observable. Also, if we do this perturbative quantum field theory, you have to keep in mind that it's actually not really an observable in the full quantum field theory, because it's technically this quantum operator will be only an observable in the free theory. Because basically, what one typically computes are scattering amplitudes and things which happen in the free regime. So basically, the Hilbert space we construct is actually only the one for the free theory. and we don't really construct the Hilbert space for the interacting theory. Now, the problem with this strategy is that it first perturbative quantum gravity fails. Then also perturbative quantum gravity, of course, is for a particular background and for a particular topology of space-time. Here in this context, it's asymptotically flat space-time, for instance. But we also are interested in situations where we have a closed universe, and so you cannot make any reference to any kind of space and time, or time and infinity. And that applies if you need to think about these things, in particular if you are interested in extreme regimes or crucial questions, for instance, like the Big Bang. Then you expect that perturbative quantum gravity doesn't lead you further into the thing. So if you want to do quantum gravity, and it's a bit of picture, the picture here is a bit so-called canonical quantum gravity. Canonical quantum gravity is where you really want to construct a Hilbert space which carries a representation of your observables. So one aim would be actually to have a Hilbert space supporting diffeomorphism invariant excitations. And that's basically one problem, because it turns out diffeomorphism invariant excitations would be wave functions which already satisfy the equations of motion. So it would be like you have to solve the Schrödinger equation. In this case, it's called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to actually construct the Hilbert space. And as Philip told you, you have also constructed something like an inner product on the Hilbert space. So the entire thing would be fully interacting. There's no natural choice for space and time coordinates. And these objects, like the metric tensor, it's not an observable. Now you could say, okay, of course it's not an observable because it has indices, but also any scalar field evaluated at some space-time point will not be an observable in gravity. And the reason is that these objects are not diffeomorphism invariant. So the space-time coordinates have no physical significance, and you need to implement diffeomorphism invariants, and that's there's basically two steps. One is that you want to have diffeomorphism invariant observables, and that would be the main topic of my talk. The second is basically the step which Philip said is constraint quantization. That basically means you want to get rid of fluctuations in your choice of coordinates. You don't want to include that, so you look for diffeomorphism invariant wave functions. And that would be the construction of the physical Hilbert space. So you don't want to assign unphysical quantum fluctuations to your choice of coordinates. So in gravity, diffeomorphic symmetry, or basically more naive, you could say coordinate transformation, is a gauge symmetry of the theory. And here, for me, the theory of gravity, I usually mean general relativity. And coordinate transformation include transformation in time. So this includes time translations. And if you want to have an observable which is invariant under time translations, well, you get something. You get the requirement that physical observable should be invariant under these time translations, so they should be constant in time. And this argument leads to this nebulous problem of time or the frozen time formalism. And that was discussed for well, some time, but parallel to that, it was already known, at least classically, how to solve it. So here's the solution, which also Philip mentioned, that's to use relational observables, and that goes back a long time. and basically the idea, if you say something like the position of a particle, that in itself is not an observable. It would be an observable in quantum mechanics, but not in these systems where time translations are a gauge symmetry. But if you say position of a particle at 5 p.m. on Philip's clock, which he doesn't have, so on Philip's laptop clock, is an observable. Because you actually choose a reference system in this statement. And this also allows you a notion of evolution with respect to Philip's clock. So basically, if you ask what is the position of the particle at 5 p.m. on Philip's clock, at 6 p.m. on Philip's clock, and so on, and of course, you will get different answers. and if you choose these observables, there is a notion of physical Hamiltonian. So we say physical Hamiltonian, it just means that this would be a Hamiltonian really in the usual sense, that it evolves the system with respect to Philip's clock. And the rest of the universe, and for technical things, but it would not evolve Philip's clock, because this would be what Philip called a perspective. And usually, if you do this, for instance, this gauge fixing procedure, the degree of freedom which describes Philip's clock would be taken out of the system and would be just a classical C number. So you could say, oh, you use these relational observables, you can describe time evolution basically with respect to clocks. So maybe there's actually no problem of time. And indeed, so I make here a difference between naive problem of time and the actual problems. So what are the actual problems? For some time, basically there was this question even what to identify observables in the canonical formalism. And the problem is that these are pre or post dictions. So if you say, oh, what is the position of part of the particle at 5 p.m., the point is that you need to find these observables for any time, because your phase space would include the notion, would include the time. And so you would need to know what is the position of the particle at 5 p.m. Also, if you are at the phase space point, which is 4 p.m., 3 p.m., or 6 p.m., so you always need basically to solve the dynamics to write down these observables on your phase space if you want to do canonical quantization. And well, there was at some point some debate of how many observables do in principle exist. But you can in principle calculate these observables and also you can define them, you can define a perturbative scheme to calculate them perturbatively. And I have developed that together with a student at that time, Johannes Tamonino, some time ago. So basically this calculational problem you can address. But there still is a problem which we will see here, because all these calculations, of course, are in perturbation, or they are expressed in a series, which is not surprising because you can only solve the system completely and nicely if they are integrable, and mostly the systems in nature are not really integrable. And this also relates to this problem of good clocks. So that's the actual problem. What are good clocks or perfect clock? A perfect clock would be a function, a phase-space function. So that would be your naive notion of observable, any kind of phase-space function. But it would have to go only in one direction on each phase-space point. And the problem is this global requirement. So it's not a problem to find clocks which go forward on some region of phase space, but the problem is to find a clock which goes forward in all of phase space. So it's also just the problem of finding good gauge fixing. So you already have that problem in Young-Mills theory. And related to that, if you don't have these good clocks in this relational formalism, you know, here I said you can calculate these observables, but the problem is that locally you can find expressions which are invariant. But the problem is that can you show that really smooth and well-defined observables exist on all of phase space? That's why classically we don't really have such a problem, because classically, well, in some sense, we don't need to know things on all of phase space. Quantum theory is, unfortunately, is a procedure which needs lots of global information. So especially canonical quantization. So things like the spectrum of your observable will depend very much on what your observable does on all of phase space. And even if you say, for me, observables are only self-adjoint operators, to decide whether something is self-adjoint, you need to know the observable, the entire flow of your observable. Now, the spectrum is just if it's compact, you get a discrete spectrum. If it is non-compact, you will get a non-discrete spectrum. And all these things will be basically decided by the global property of your observable. And so far, so the main problem is that we have not found perfect clocks which are natural. So I'm going to explain what natural means, because there were many things added to GR in terms of meta, for instance, which you can use as clocks. And these are usually constructed so that they are good clocks, like ESA series and so on. But you might say that they are not really natural, because they might not exist in nature. And on the other hand, knowing this has interesting consequences for the structure of the theory. And basically, the main point, I will give you two examples of that. And you can actually also see that as basically the question, maybe we should go away from this global requirements, for instance, of canonical quantization. And that's basically also one direction which Philip developed. So this is a question, maybe is there a way to have more local rules in some sense for quantization? Okay. So our choice of clocks determines our notion of time. And so if there's no perfect clock, of course, there's also not really a canonical choice of our time. So we have to make some choice. It will not be perfect. But all these notions of time will be a crucial ingredient in quantum theory. If you think about it, it will determine, you know, what is actually unitary evolution. And actually, without a global time, we don't actually know what it even means to have a unitary evolution. Such things like wave function collapse, which I'm not sure how it works in a relativistic theory, but usually that also works in time. Also, Hamiltonian and energy depend on your notion, on your choice of time. And with Hamiltonian energy comes, of course, the notion of vacuum. So for instance, quantum gravity, we a priori could choose different Hamiltonians depending on your choice of time, and that would lead to different vacua states. So all these notions a priori depend on choice of time and therefore clocks. As I mentioned, actually, so there's a long, long history of discussing possible clocks or gauge choices for GR, or adding things which you can use as clocks, either in full general relativity or in reduced systems, like for quantum cosmology. One choice are geometrical clocks. So this means you take actually degrees of freedom in your system of your metric, for instance, or of something conjugated to the metric. So it has the advantage that no additional matter is required. Typically, these choices are very non-local and to some extent quite unpractical. For instance, an old proposal from Peter Bergmann is to use a scalar invariance you construct out of the Ricci and Riemann tensors. And well, that's first of all not very practical, because around Minkowski space that will be a very bad choice. And of course, it's also extremely hard to compute. So we can make this proposal, but there's not much. I mean, you cannot do anything with this. Some time ago, I had proposed something which works very well around fixed space times. And so it does allow to reconstruct what we know from quantum field theory on curved space times, for instance. So these are also clocks which are actually constructed out of metric degrees of freedom. They're highly non-local, but that's what you have to use, for instance, to just reconstruct our notion of time, which we usually use in quantum field theory. So they basically do fix time globally by saying I try to take time slices which are like as straight, as near to Minkowski as possible in my space-time, and that's kind of a very global notion. And so these allow to describe the QFT limit. You can compute them perturbatively, and so you can describe fluctuations of light cones. So this shows that in principle, from mathematically at least, you can even construct something, or you can expect that you can take the limit and reconstruct Minkowski space or quantum field theory on Minkowski space. It's a non-trivial statement, because a priori Minkowski space is something with lots of symmetries, and it's not clear that you can construct anything with clocks, because it's an empty space, so what should you take? But it turns out that the metric degrees of freedom also include this notion of time. So that's not done very often yet. More often, people take these meta clocks, and basically there's two avenues you can take. One is that you add some unnatural matter, and I say unnatural because it's artificial in the sense that you say, or you include a Lagrangian for dust. And then by construction, what you can measure there with the dust is that you assume that each dust particle you can distinguish from each other. So each dust particle has a name, and you can always read off this name, and each dust particle has its own proper time, so you can always read the clock of this dust particle. So this, of course, shows you, well, you can maybe use a planet as dust, but the question is, are these clocks really reasonable if you want to describe deep quantum gravity regime? And that's usually the problem, because the quantum gravity effects we expect, they come really from like the Planckian regime. And then you, at least I don't assume that I meet a dust particle in this case, where I can read off the clock from a dust particle. And so that's also the ESER. So ESER was in particular developed by Ted Jacobson, which is a reasonable thing to do, because he did derive lots of constraints which just come from the for instance the solar system on the existence of ether. A second option you can take is to really consider relativistic matter. So here, typically, well, it's easier to take scalar fields. Of course, there's also the question, how do you measure the value of a scalar field? I have no idea. And I will describe one effect, which is a bound on resolution, which you can achieve if you really take relativistic matter as compared to non-relativistic matter. And we have seen this small effect already in Philip's talk. So this would be something which follows, which is more a local aspect of having no good clocks. And that is now this relativistic versus unrelativistic clocks. And the point is, Philip spoke of constraints, but they are all part of a Hamiltonian, and in the Hamiltonian you typically have something which gives you the kinetic energy. And then there's a big difference of whether you have your kinetic energy as quadratic in the momentum, which usually is the case, or as linear in the momentum. Well, if you just think a bit, if you have a momentum conjugated to time, if your Hamiltonian is linear in the momentum, it means that the commutator of time and Hamiltonian is one, so the time would always go forward. If you have something quadratic, it means it can go forward or backward, or it cannot go at all. And in fact, this little difference makes a big difference for properties of relational observables. And then, well, an example where there's an entire book about it is actually the time of arrival operator. So in this case, you have a Hamiltonian, and it's basically, it turns out it's a constraint. So here, the entire Hamiltonian is also constrained, and it's called a totally constrained system in this case. And the Hamiltonian just describes a free particle, but what you do is to also add time to your system. In this case, you have just a system where the Hamiltonian is Pt plus your usual Hamiltonian, and Pt just puts time forward. Now you need to consider observables which are commuting with this Hamiltonian. And actually, you can make a simple choice to say, if I want to consider relational observables, I choose time as my observable. And then you can ask, what is the position of my particle if the time has this value, tau? And it's easy to compute that you find this value, this thing. So it's already solving, it's always a prediction because it tells you, given a phase-based point, Q and P, it tells you what will be the position of the particle at the time tau. This can be quantized without problems, and you can do this perspective and perspective-free quantization, and you can map each thing to each other, so you will not have any problems on this side. Now you can also say, oh, let me try to take Q, the position of the particle, as a clock. And then you can ask, what is the time at the point where the particle reaches a certain position? And that's known as the time of arrival operator. And then you can compute what this is. And you see here already a slight problem because you have m divided by a momentum. And then you have q, so you have also an ordering problem. And in fact, well, it cannot turn into a self-adjoint operator if you don't specify something in addition. And in addition is really the problem, what do you do if you are sitting at pq equal to zero? And well, there's kind of two or three papers by Aharonov, Unruh, Reschnick, and somebody else. And actually, they discuss some kind of additional uncertainty relation, and that's just the uncertainty relation that you can not determine this time of arrival expectation value to arbitrary precision. So this uncertainty relation only involves one operator. And the related effect is actually exactly the same effect And it really comes only if you have something at least quadratic in your momenta, is basically a bound on the resolution you have. So here, imagine you have at least 5 scalar fields in your system, and you have also gravity. And what you can ask is for the two-point function of your scalar field you observe relative to the 4 scalar fields you use as clocks. So clocks means you use one as clock and the other 3 as coordinates. And then you can basically compute this two-point function. This two-point function in quantum field theory will be basically determined just by actually the Poisson brackets in your classical system. And you can do that approximately for these observables. So now they are really diffeomorphism invariant observables, approximate in the distance of these two positions. And you will find that you will find the usual Green's function on a fixed background, just expressed in these new coordinates. So that's good. But you find an extra term. And that extra term looks a bit more complicated, what I wrote here, but basically it's the energy of your field you observe divided by the energy of the fields you use as clocks. So if you want to make this extra term small, just to be able to resolve 2 points with high precision, you have to make the energy of your clocks very high. Especially if the energy of your field is very large. But if you really have gravity in your system, you cannot concentrate an arbitrary amount of energy on in a small region and deform a black hole at some point. So from this, you can in principle derive a bound, a strong bound on the number of degrees of freedom if you assume that this Green's function actually determines of how well you can resolve 2 points in your system. And if you assume basically, well, if I have no way to resolve points in my system, then these degrees of freedom should actually not exist. And this was used to derive this bound. So that was on a very heuristic level. But it shows you that indeed, these observables might have various bounds built into them. If you really don't use artificial clocks, if you only use things which are actually existent in nature, you get already a bound on kind of the notion of space-time points. So indeed, one lesson here is that these space-time points do not exist, and some these notions of measure something at a given space-time point is not an observable. So here, if you have black holes in your system, which develop if you concentrate in high energy, you have basically, in fact, the problem that you cannot resolve 2 points to arbitrary position, and there is no perfect loss. Okay, so that was basically the main topic of Philip, so I don't want to discuss that. So back then, this was these 3 papers Philip mentioned. One resolution you could take, but in this case it was still in a local framework because it was a semi-classical quantization. You could say if I don't have one perfect clock which would work throughout the trajectory of my system, well, you might try to change your clocks throughout. And interestingly, you can, however, derive effects which are very similar to non-unitary evolution. So this was one example for local aspects. So there's also, of course, lots of other works on what follows if you really have to use, for instance, these relational observables and really physical clocks to make measurements. Let me describe a global aspect. And this global aspect was actually a problem which many people mostly worried about in gravity and the viability of the canonical quantization program. And this is again, something, yeah, maybe more philosophically, assume you have a universe which evolves completely periodically. So everything is periodic. But this means that actually there's no observable which counts the cycles. So any time on a chosen clock is always referring to infinitely many moments of time, namely the one, well, it's one time in each cycle. But in this case, all these moments are indeed physically indistinguishable. So in fact, you get the exact result here, and well, it's, of course, you always model, and you don't model yourself in it, in the system. So if we do describe the system and say, okay, some outside like me can count how many cycles the universe goes through, but I haven't included me in my description. So really, the canonical quantization program tells you, well, there is no way to make sense out of the notion even I've gone from one cycle to the next. So basically, there only exists these periodic orbit and phase space, which you quantize. But this is indeed a periodic system, so it means basically something quite, you would expect this is integrable. But what happens if we are in a chaotic regime? And if even clocks cannot differentiate between a priori distinguishable moments. And in fact, as Philip Heth mentioned, the so-called FRW, so Friedman, Robertson, Walker dynamics, is a family of solutions of general relativity, which is homogeneous. If you consider, well, k equal to 1 and a massive scalar field, that has definitely chaotic regimes in it. With Philip and Tim Kozlowski, we considered a simple model for this system. So it's not really true chaos, but it has this property that there's no smooth observable which can differentiate between orbits. And so here's a simple model. You consider a particle on a two-dimensional torus, and if the particle winds around the torus, you can of course have two situations: that the orbits of the particle are periodic, or they actually fill densely the torus. And in this, if you take really this Hamiltonian of the system, here minus the energy as a constraint, it means that you have a symmetry in the system, which is, again, time reparametrizations that you can basically along the orbit reparametrize your choice of time in an arbitrary way. And that means the only observables which are allowed, they do not refer to a specific point on the orbit, but they have to differentiate between the orbits. So you look for an observable which differentiates between the orbits. And what you will find, of course, the momenta of the system are observables because they're just constants of motion. But you will find that there is not really a configuration observable which would differentiate between these dense orbits. And I said, no, actually, there is a configuration observable. But what I mean, there is no smooth configuration observable which differentiates between orbits. And that will be an important point. So in fact, if you go through, well, the standard quantization methods we have for these systems, which Philip also mentioned, one is reduced phase space quantization. Well, that basically fails because you find no gauge fixing or perspective which would work. You can also do standard Dirac quantization. So you can actually apply standard Dirac quantization. You find a physical Hilbert space, but it turns out that the physical Hilbert space, if you look at this quantization, if you look at the system, because of the periodicity, the momenta will have discrete spectra. And so depending on your energy, you get a number theoretic problems and a kind of a Diophantine equation. And the solutions you get to the system are not enough to actually construct semi-classical states. Wow. Okay. So, sorry. So both these methods which we know fail. And well, and then we were already at the point to write off canonical quantization. But is there anything which can be done? And as I mentioned, the important point is that there is a configuration observable, so which is really invariant, but it's actually nowhere differentiable. So it's some painful thing. It's very non-smooth on configuration space. And in fact, it turns out you can in fact construct a quantum theory, but you have to adjust your quantization method to this observable, and in some sense to the topology of this observable. And in this case, the observable in some sense has a it is defined in a discrete topology. Because if you choose a discrete topology on this configuration space, this function is continuous, because if you choose a discrete topology, basically everything is continuous. So you choose a discrete topology on configuration space. If you have ever heard that is actually equivalent to a so-called Bohr compactification of momentum space. So you might have heard that quantum mechanics is unique for one-dimensional systems, the Stone von Neumann theorem. This, however, assumes that momentum and configuration variable that the unitary operators, which you can build out of them, are strongly continuous operators. And here you violate this condition for the momentum operator, I believe. Yeah, you violate this condition for the momentum operator. And for that reason, the momentum operator actually will only exist as an exponentiated observable. So it's only exponential IP, which epsilon, which exists, and you cannot take epsilon to zero. So that's one of the modifications that you actually introduce this epsilon. So we choose this discrete topology on the configuration. And in fact, it leads to a sufficiently large physical Hilbert space, which carries a representation of this funny configuration observable and of the momentum observable. Just that here you should put in exponentiated momentum observable. And so in principle, it works. But of course, it has consequences, because for instance, the spectrum of the observable, like the momentum observable, now we have exponentiated. You change the spectrum from being bounded to being unbounded. So also energy now will be actually a bounded function. And the bound depends on this epsilon you have chosen. And actually, what happened with this funny discrete topology, in some sense, we have unwound the torus. if you can calculate some things, because it's a fun system. So before winding things around the torus, you get a wave function which looks reasonable regular. That would be something like the physical wave function, but expressed in this kinematical configuration space. And then you have to basically wrap around this thing, around the torus. And if your mass ratios are kind of irrational, and you do it for a number of times, you get something highly irregular. So that is. These topological tricks are always easy to use to simulate something like chaotic behavior. and so, of course, here, that would be a physical wave function. So it's extremely hard to interpret in your original kinematical Hilbert space or in your with respect to your smooth topology. And for some reason, this funny discretization introduced a lattice, and this lattice is, however, not closing exactly on itself. And this effect actually allowed you to unwind the torus. So it was a funny effect. But what if you take this example serious, it has really a lesson. And this lesson is that, in principle, we should learn more about the structure of our observables, because that's what we have to represent in our quantum theory. And here we have seen that. Well, if you don't know something about your observables, you nevertheless do constraint quantization, your Hilbert space is way too small. And in fact, it seems so that kind of observables people have constructed might be much more non-smooth than what we usually assume in quantum field theory. That brings me to the summary. So it was a short talk here. So in quantum gravity, we have to use relational observables. So far, we don't have a perfect choice for the reference system, and therefore no canonical time. But basically, the properties of observables and therefore the properties of quantum spacetime do actually depend on this choice of clocks. And there's this point, you know, the difference between adding unnatural clocks and adding and only using relativistic clocks is, for me, really important. And typically, people avoid this because it's really hard to quantize even in simple systems because you have to go through all this time of arrival operator things. But it might hint at really the structure of quantum spacetime in itself, which is basically this work which derived some bound on the number of degrees of freedom you can have. The difficulty, as I mentioned, is that really in quantization, if you follow this, quantization always needs all these global properties of your system, and these are difficult to get in more realistic systems, and especially if you're quadratic. And so this needs to be basically studied more. Or we need an alternative to our quantization scheme here. As I mentioned, so most of these works assume canonical quantization. Canonical quantization is this hugely global procedure. So you can basically ask, is that sensible? So in quantum gravity, you know, you aim to represent basically the space-time, all kind of space-time solutions in the Hilbert space. And even when you make a space-time split, that's not the main issue, actually, in my experience. But it's really that to know what observables, what kind of spectrum they have, you need to know the observables on all of phase space. And that is also a main issue, and maybe some more kind of local quantization systems or quantization things, for instance, Philip developed, could be useful in this respect. So it's basically, can you develop quantization methods which already tell you something before you know the full system or the full dynamics? And in general, okay, so that's basically this notion that the properties of observables, as we have seen in the last example, they should inform the construction of quantum gravity theory. And basically, we have seen that the standard smooth topology quantization didn't work in this one system. But if you adjust the topology to the observables you actually have, it does work. Thank you.
Clocks around. Uh-huh. And so it must be the case that you can formulate physical theories in the complete absence of, or in the absence of clocks. Is it what would you say to that?
Well, first you should be precise about if you say, how do you know that the universe goes around your business if no clocks around? Do you mean there are solutions exist?
Oh, I mean, I just mean there's no objects, no physical objects identified as constituting clocks. I mean,
yeah, so this is what you would say, we can do the constraint quantization, this Dirac quantization perspective, which would be the perspective-free notion or whatever, the system. That would be the aim, but nobody managed so far. And the technical problem is that according to, say, the canonical quantization problem, canonical quantization program, you know, there's these two methods, reduced quantization and Dirac quantization. And reduced quantization says basically find a gauge fixing, which would be good gauge fixing, and then use it and do your quantization as you usually do. So the problem is it fails in the first step because nobody has found a good gauge fixing. Well, only in situations if you add these metaclocks, and even there it hasn't been done really on the full system, apart that you can of course write down more or less well-defined things, but not solve anything. So there's this problem. Then there's Dirac quantization. Even in Dirac quantization, it says construct this physical Hilbert space. For this, you have to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. There's a Wheeler-DeWitt equation. To solve it means that it's like the Schrödinger system for the Schrödinger equation for the entire universe. So basically, that's also a bit hard to solve. And even before that, it basically says you have to do all kinds of choices for operator ordering and your Wheeler-DeWitt equation, so that eventually all your observables, you can represent a sufficiently large set of observables. And there's a problem that we don't even know a sufficiently large set of observables. You could say there's a hope once you have a Hilbert space, or once you have an abstract way to construct your Hilbert space, you can then construct the observables. And this we can all see in theory, but the usual problem is actually to do these calculations practically. And that's maybe one of the main problems. But even before that, the problem is that even if you don't choose any kind of clocks and you ask for observables, that we practically we don't know any of these observables explicitly. And well, here, nevertheless, you can ask, well, abstractly, what kind of observations can I make in principle? So like that, for in a periodic universe, you can only observe things periodically. Or for Minkowski space, could I ever find out that I'm in Minkowski space? So you can kind of ask this question and try to learn more about structure of observables.
Terms of this underlying. When you talk about the structure of observables, mm-hmm. you mean in terms of the underlying theory?
Well, the structure of observables is on the first level, it's a classical question, so it's just general relativity. But then if you express these phase space functions in phase space, then I think nobody can tell you, are there sufficiently many smooth phase space, or are there sufficiently many smooth observables, for instance, on phase space, so that you can actually achieve canonical quantization. You know, or how local are these? So what was discussed in much more detail recently by Giddings and William, which is here, which is a question of locality of observables. And that's what I also did a long time ago, like locality and causality of observables. And these questions, for instance, were important for say these things with the firewall paradox. So the firewall paradox is about black holes and the horizon, and basically it's derived that if you assume unitary dynamics and a bunch of other things, well, it turns out that there's a contradiction in your entanglement structure. If you assume that nothing special happens at the horizon, the alternative is that you have something ugly happening at the horizon, which was called the firewall. Now, if you look at the derivation of the system, it uses some assumption about entanglement. To define entanglement, you have to subdivide your system into subsystems. And that's a bit dangerous in quantum field theory in any case, because the Hilbert space does not separate in local subsystems, already mathematically for technical reasons. And quantum gravity is even much more a question. Because of these constraints, you don't even you can easily show that the Hilbert space does not factorize into subsystems already before all these mathematical problems arise. And so on the observable level, it is indeed, can you define observables, which would basically really define something like local subsystems? And that's basically one of the main questions. You can learn about the structure of the theory to have something like to try to derive some bounds on the locality of your systems. And of course, all these games about entanglement, they typically assume that you can factorize your Hilbert space, but it might not be true in principle. And that's these examples where we should learn much more about the structure of the observable algebra concerning these things. And yeah. So Giddings, Steve Giddings, and William Donnelly had a bunch of papers on these problems.
In the final example that you gave with this torus and the irrational winding, in that quantization where you choose a different topology, there's a isolated set of periodic orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if they play any special role in that quantization or not.
Did we discuss this? I think the problem here is that they don't show up here at all. But I have to check.
The reason I'm asking is there's a very different system, which is just an anisotropic 2D harmonic oscillator, which also will wind a torus.
Yeah,
right? And in that case, you can do a Goetz-Wheeler trace. You can do a semi-classical treatment of that anisotropic system. And the Goetz-Wheeler trace formula is really built out of the periodic orbits. Even though they're isolated, you get a good approximation to the density of states from just the periodic orbits. And so I'm curious if this change of topology really... It's a very different system because that's it's a non-relativistic example. You're not doing this.
You don't do this constraint quantization. Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
very different.
I think the constraint quantization depends on the energy that you choose, whether you get
periodic or not
periodic. Or non-periodic. Yeah, I think the constraint basically eliminates the periodic ones.
Yeah, I would have checked. In the classical, in the smooth topology, where you get a few solutions, I need to remember whether they corresponded to periodic orbits, but they're not enough to get you any kind of semi-classical evolution. And in this case, we really considered something like also what Carlo Rovelli calls a propagator. What is he calling that? Propagator. And that didn't give you not enough information.
So the Goetz-Wheeler trace formula is anyway about density of states and for different energy levels, right?
Yeah.
And then this year, because the constraint exists in 2-1 energy, then this is not really relevant anymore.
But still, it'd be interesting if the periodic orbits play a special role.
Yeah, we have to look at it. What we did explicitly is to really construct the semi-classical states in both, try to construct semi-classical states in both systems and in both examples. In the first example, it fails. And in the second example, you can do that, and we can look at what happens there, and then you can consider also the propagator. Okay.
I'm sorry. Actually, I have a somewhat simple-sounding question, but the answer might be somewhat complicated. How do you quantify chaos here?
So in this case, we are only looking for an example where you have orbits which are densely filling the configuration space. But there are lots of other notions of chaos, like Lyapunov exponents, these Poincaré map countings, and the student of Philip.
The statistics of the energy levels.
Statistics of energy levels is not really well defined, because usually if you have a totally constrained system, there's not really an energy.
I would argue that here there's a problem with trying to define a trajectory, right?
That's very defined. There is a trajectory. It just said in the system we cannot refer to any given point on a trajectory, but only we can only ask about the full the different trajectories.
Maybe you can also say something else. I mean, it's more about defining a notion of non-interoperability here rather than chaos.
But this is not exactly the same thing.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So non-interoperability is something more general. But so non-interoperability usually means you don't have smooth constants of motion of some autonomous Hamiltonian. And here, basically, it's more about extending or defining a notion of non-integrability for Hamiltonian constraints, which means then that Dirac observables, Gauge invariant observables, and you would call them non-integrable if you don't have a complete set of differentiable constants of motion of these constraints.
Right, we are talking about conserved quantities that allow me to reduce somewhat that degree of the dynamical system.
So it's more about non-integrability here. I mean, it turns out that in this FRW model, it actually is also chaotic. So it's so here you can define in terms of entropic measures like topological entropy and so on. It's a property of the space of solution, and you can find the these models actually have a non-vanishing entropy, which we'll call it as a chaotic system. So you can do this here, but it's more about non-integrability.
Okay.
Yeah. So chaos sounded a bit more exciting than non-integrability. I should also mention that these is a special kind of chaos or non-integrability, because you can also have a system of chaos and can turn it into a parameterized system. And in this case, you wouldn't have this problem, because you can always use a time parameter R sub clock, and then everything is well. And this is really, these are special, that there's really no such time parameter which you can choose here. But it happens that this FRW example, at least in quantum cosmology, falls into this class. And there is literature on people, I mean, there's literature of other people, and one of Smeed Cornish, which indeed studied kind of this system and related system. So there's a couple of papers which we all cited in our papers, or we tried to cite them all. Where people try to use these different measures to specify chaos.
Yeah.
Because actually, we didn't know, but like half of the people would say they were worried about the problem, and another half of the people say, oh, yeah, they don't expect chaos, chaotic regime for some reason, which we don't understand. So there's a bit of debate of how to define chaos in these systems. But there's also lots of literature. At least in these reduced systems. So the question is full general relativity of this kind? Okay.
So let's thank Bianca again and